So Rwanda, think genocide, in 1994, spurred on by, well, extremist Hutus on the radio calling for the extermination of Tutsis and moderate Hutus, somewhere between 500,000 and 1,000,000 were killed by ordinary Hutu citizens. And that was the real tragedy, that many of those killed were targeted by their own neighbours, hacked to death at roadblocks and in churches and schools in broad daylight. Now, 25 years on, the country is keen to project an image of progress and prosperity. But how much has Rwanda really progressed? And is there a chance of a slide back into genocide? Associate Professor Susan Thompson is author of a new book called Rwanda, From Genocide to Precarious Peace. And she was also program officer for the United Nations Development Programme in 1994 and in the country when the genocide took place. Susan, welcome.
Thank you, Philip.
Refresh our memory on the conflict. A civil war had been raging from what, 1990?
Yeah, there had been a civil war that the now ruling Rwandan Patriotic Front had initiated in October 1990 from its southern neighbor, Uganda, so crossing into northern Rwanda from southern Uganda. With the aid of Ugandans, the Rwandan Patriotic Front made a move to restore democracy and to restore ethnic unity. That was their ideological basis. Of course, we now know that they were unable to defeat the forces of the then government of Juvenal Habyarimana, and genocide eventually ensued as a last-ditch effort to maintain peace for the Hutu hardliners that you mentioned in your opening.
I understand that, and I'd forgotten this, that in April 6, 1994, a plane was shot down that rekindled the civil war.
Yes, that's exactly right. So the academic consensus early on was that the plane was the flashpoint for the genocide, and the roadblocks went up and the genocide started that night, in which they began to eliminate Hutu moderates, as you mentioned, but also Tutsi politicians who were interested in negotiating peace. We now know through the careful work of scholars that the genocide likely started on April 12th, and it was a result of the machinations and strategy of a small group of Hutu hardliners who were bent on killing Tutsi to preserve their political power, keeping it at the full expense of the RPF. And a little known fact is that the now ruling RPF at that time also sought power. So, of course, they saved many Tutsis, but they also killed many Rwandans of all ethnicities in their drive to take statehouse.
We'll sort of deconstruct the horrors as our conversation continues, but let the record show that in just 100 days, between 500,000 and 1,000,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus were killed by their neighbours. And as we vividly recall, the weapon of choice seemed to be machetes. Now, you were there. What did you see?
I didn't see as much as I could have, I suppose. I was holed up in the United Nations office on the evening of April 6th. We heard a loud bang. There was definitely a flash. Confusion ensued, obviously, and it wasn't until probably 45 minutes to an hour later that we were radioed and told to stay in place. So we, with several colleagues, Rwandan and expat, we stayed in the UN compound just beyond the Milcolin Hotel. So for people who know Kigali or have observed it on Google Earth, just a block or two away from the main center where the Hutu extremists had targeted Tutsis who'd taken safety at the Milcolin Hotel. So I was really holed up with colleagues. I didn't explore or go out. We were then exited with UN aides, I guess, UN transport by road to Kampala in Uganda. So the exact path that the RPF had followed 4 years prior, we followed that road to relative safety.
Susan, in introducing you and the whole Rwandan horror story, I mentioned that it's estimated that between 500,000 and 1,000,000 were killed. Why is that figure so loose?
That's a really good question. Human rights advocates and scholars generally pick the lower number of 500,000 because those are the deaths that we are able to verify that actually were killed in the genocide. The current government has had a systemic interest in reframing the genocide into a million killed. And if you look at their numbers starting from 1994, late 1994 indeed, the numbers have systematically increased over time. So they now say, and it is official in the record of the government, that a million Tutsi were killed. So we have scholars who've done demographic work to show from census documents, from World Bank documents, and from human rights documents that that number is elevated. You then have members of the Rwandan diaspora who are not happy with the political situation and have long been unhappy with the political situation as early as 1998, saying that those 1 million deaths are actually Hutu who were targeted. So you have this murky situation in which the government is elevating the number of killed for their own political purpose. We stop the genocide, we save Tutsi, and then you have the opposite, the diaspora, which is largely managed by Hutu elite, Hutu politicians, but also some Tutsi politicians who say, well, that number may be correct, but we must admit there was a double genocide. Scholarship is very clear on this. There was no double genocide in Rwanda. It's a political tactic of the opposition. So you have a Tutsi-led government that's very interested in maintaining the narrative of genocide against only Tutsi, and you have a diaspora that's claiming double genocide. So it gets murky because we think only of the deaths that occurred in those 100 days, when in fact deaths had started as early as the Civil War and continued long after the genocide officially ended. So we can see those deaths are elevated for political purposes.
Reading through your book in anticipation of tonight, I suddenly remember a conversation I had with a Canadian general who was in charge of the UN troops and who was, of course, held back from participating. And I remember he was a total emotional wreck. And, it, of course, so many of the survivors of the genocide would also be, to this day and forever, total emotional wrecks.
Well, I think that's right. You have a government that has denied the lived experience of almost everyone who lived through the genocide. So you have a situation in which the previous government, the Hutu-led government, had maintained a war footing and had made it possible for Hutu to imagine to kill their neighbors. And, of course, they had to prime them. So there is this idea that Rwandans are predisposed to genocide. It's just not true. You have a state system that primes people to kill their neighbors. So, number one, you do have this incidence, as you noted, machetes and other farm tools were used to kill kith and kin, but you also have a post-genocide government who pays no regard to the ways in which people were energized and trained, for lack of a better word, to take on the grisly task.
Well, in many ways, coerced and forced, because as your book points out, many Hutus resisted killing their neighbours and were, as a consequence, killed themselves. And many Hutus participated only to save their own lives.
Yes, I think that's correct. And the scholarship is actually quite clear on this as more scholars take up the role of rescuers. So in the early days of the post-genocide era, we focused on the human rights abuses of both sides, the ruling party and the defeated party. And of course, over time, we begin to understand the way that ordinary people made hard decisions to kill their kith and kin or to hide or to kill some Tutsi and save other Tutsi because they knew them. So that social network theory has actually done a lot of work to show us why people killed, when they killed, and who they saved. And now, 25 years later, scholarship has finally turned to the role of rescuer. So as you noted, many Rwandans resisted. They didn't always resist fully, but they resisted insofar as they rescued some and killed others. Or, as we see with religious leaders, many of them actually worked very hard to save their flock and died in the process. So as they died, their flock also died. It was, of course, a situation in which total annihilation was the goal. The difference is, was it targeted Tutsi or was it targeted pasture? So Rwanda gets a little bit confusing because the ethnic question makes it more tricky because this government, of course, has made it illegal to talk about ethnicity.
Susan, tell the listener the story of Hutu Marie and her Tutsi husband Bosco and their son Prosper.
Marie and Bosco are a young Rwandan married couple. They eventually found their family. They have an oldest son, Joseph, and two daughters. Bosco is eventually killed, potentially of AIDS, but we don't actually know, in the refugee camps in neighboring Congo. So many Rwandans fled into Congo as the genocide ended in August 1994, late July 1994 as well, shoved along and pulled along by the retreating forces of Habyarimana's government. Marie, of course, is a poor farmer. She owns some land. She is, however, unable to provide for her family, and her son Joseph hopes to break out on his own, found a family, live an adult life, and he's unable to do so because as a rural person, a poor person, a person with a limited education, he's unable to grasp the promise of Kigali that, you know, is such the focus of media at the moment. So we have a dead dad, a mother who survived the genocide, their child died, they refound a family, and the new children, the promise of Rwanda, the future of Rwanda, are unable to move into adulthood.
The RPF claimed to save a lot of Tutsis as they took control, but as the book points out, they also committed more than their fair share of atrocities.
Yes, that's the emergent consensus. It's also something the government takes great issue with. They deny this reality. They've done so systematically through constitutional revision, through memorials, through the rewriting of history, through incentivization of individuals who are members of the ruling party and who decide what can be spoken when and by whom. So, of course, we now see a situation in which people like Marie, people like her children, are unable to say, well, my dad died as a result of genocide or a result of the lack of social services and resources after the genocide. So you have this clash between the official history, the history that comes from the government, and how rural people are living their lives. And that's one thing that's sort of muted in the public eye right now. Rwanda's still a very rural country. 80 to 85% of Rwandans, like Marie, like Joseph, live as subsistence farmers. They eat what they can grow. That's how they survive. School fees are often outside of their reach. Health care services, which are greatly vaunted in the new Rwanda, are available for certain kinds of people, but not always for people like Marie and Joseph. So you have this widening inequality gap that the government's not really addressing in pursuit of a singular history of heroes and bad guys.
Susan, in the immediate aftermath of the war, a great many Hutu hardliners who'd encouraged the genocide flee the country and encourage others to do so. So we saw those refugee camps building up in Zaire, the Democratic Republic of Congo, but also in Burundi, Tanzania, Uganda. And then the RPF tries to force them to return, often by burning refugee camps.
Yes, the RPF had a systematic effort starting from 1996 through to 1998 to return those Hutus. So they had, at that time, a legitimate security concern. They did not know who was there, or at least they claim not to know who was there. Many of the leaders of the genocide, those who implemented it, those who planned it, had often fled into Zaire. Zaire, of course, a big, loyal member of the African Union and a loyal friend to the Habyarimana government. So Mobutu at the time, of course, was very welcoming to the Hutu hardliners. They were able to reestablish villages and hillsides in the refugee camps. The international community was completely unprepared and, of course, supported them. And the RPF was like, look, if you're not going to return them, we will return them. The International Refugee Assistance Agencies, the UNHCR in particular, was just completely unable to manage the magnitude and, of course, set Rwanda on a path to have the RPF forcibly return people and identify them as they came back. So this wasn't always perfectly done. And in that process, many Rwandans who returned either fled deeper into the woods of Congo, the jungles of Congo, or they were forcibly returned to Rwanda. The government had in mind, these Rwandans should be in Rwanda and we will re-educate them. So so that genocide never again happens. So that's the beginning of this policy of re-education that we should do without ethnicity.
And reframing the argument and rewriting history energetically. Now, the current president, then defense minister, clearly was complicit in widespread war crimes. I understand international observers have documented many mass grave sites that were post-Civil War.
Yes, that's exactly right. So you would talk to ordinary Rwandans, people like Marie and her family, and they'd say, yeah, there's a fresh grave over there. And you would say, oh, well, from when? They're like, well, from last week. So Westerners, you know, foreign observers would come and assume that was a genocide grave, when in fact that was a fresh grave that had just been made, you know, the month before. So, of course, as we all know, it takes several months for a human body to decompose. So you could also, in those early days, you could really smell the sense of decay. And Rwandans themselves have a very acute sense of, like, they know who has done what, because it's such a densely populated country. And, of course, the genocide touched everyone in the country at the time. So they know, they just don't talk about it because, of course, it's illegal and it's tricky to do so.
The president's efforts to bring the perpetrators of war crimes to book, please.
Well, they instituted a local court system, a neo-traditional court system, in fact, called Gachacha, and the Gachacha courts were a revival of a pre-colonial method of dispute resolution. So, of course, it wasn't designed to try crimes as dramatic as genocide. It was designed to try family disputes, you know, your cow is grazing in my pasture, your son hit my daughter, community-based disputes like this. The RPF revived it, actually against the wishes, initially anyway, of the international community, who did eventually fully fund it, 10,000 jurisdictions to have every Rwandan participate so that it was mandated in the law that you had to participate. And Rwandans did reluctantly for the most part, but of course some did enthusiastically. Many Hutu who stood accused before the Gachacha courts considered it to be a joke because they're like, we did kill, but we were told to kill. So I don't understand why I'm being charged for crimes that were the rule of the land or the law of the land in 1994. So there was a sizable disconnect between what the government hoped to accomplish and how people approached it, particularly perpetrators. Survivors in particular were quite reluctant to speak about what had happened to them, particularly women who'd been raped. There's a taboo in Rwandan society against speaking about sexual crimes. And of course, poor farmers were more interested in cultivating their fields and feeding their families than they were them performing in a bogus sort of justice system. And the government initiated it because the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda was such a disappointment to them. And then eventually they brought in the domestic courts. And of course, it bears mentioning that they had international justice in Belgium and Canada. So the war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide crimes are, of course, universal crimes and can be tried in any court. So the government's pursued a very detailed, wide-ranging justice policy at all levels of the legal system.
As you were saying earlier, in the very brief time we've got left, let's look at the now and the future. The capital of Kigali has skyscrapers, hotels, banks, shopping centres, 34 universities and technical schools, but as you point out, most of the population does not live in the cities. And I wonder how reliant Rwanda is on foreign aid.
Yeah, that's also a good question. I would argue it's quite reliant. I think we will find over time that the Rwandan economic model is premised on donor aid. The government has been unable to really provide the jobs needed to make the domestic economy the engine of economic growth. And we see a vast difference between the spoils of Kigali, let's say, and life in the rural areas. I think, you know, it's still a few years away. Donors are still investing in Rwanda. We do see some kickback about the crimes that you mentioned earlier. Paul Kagame and his RPF have committed atrocities, and the international donor community, the U.S., the U.K., Holland, Belgium, will slap them on the wrist for that. But we don't see any great decrease in donor aid. So will the economy
and of course, he controls the country very tightly, doesn't he? Criticism is not tolerated, and the RPF is painted as the nation's saviour. Oh, dear. What do you see as Rwanda's future, in a few words, Susan?
I think Rwanda will remain stable for the time being. As you noted, the RPF under President Kagame is the only game in town. He's not a particularly young guy, but he's not a particularly old guy either. He's in his early 60s, I think, right now. And I can foresee, as I say in my book, probably until 2050, the RPF can run the economy and control the military, control society to the extent that we may not see genocide-like crimes. I think something will happen. It will happen from outside in the same way. Nothing will happen domestically.
Got to go. Thank you very, very much, Susan Thompson, author of Rwanda, From Genocide to Precarious Peace. And it's published, let me see, by Yale, I think, Yale University Press.